Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity out once again today. Dan Foster of National Review Online ably taking his spot. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Dan, a lot of our talk today will be centered around yesterday's big news from Capitol Hill that Republican negotiators, at least two of the biggies, have walked out of those talks, at least for now. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor and the number two Republican in the Senate, John Kyle of Arizona. And the big issue seems to be over tax hikes that the Democrats want to do. They claim on the rich, of course, and Republicans say tax hikes in any way, shape, or form is just going to stifle job creation even more than it's already stifled. Here's Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan speaking with ABC News' Jonathan Carl about what the Republican plan, or at least those of conservatives, seems to be at this point.
We're going to go bankrupt if we don't do the right things. And the right things are cut, cap, and balance. Cut spending, cap spending as a percentage of GDP, and do a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution.
Well, Dan, the Republicans have been very consistent about this being a spending problem, not a revenue problem. It's going to be very interesting to see Democrats basically saying that tax hikes are going to be the stumbling block over whether or not we actually raise the debt ceiling. So draw the lines in the sand. It's going to be the Koch brothers versus job creators. Who wins?
I don't know, but I do know that this was sort of inevitable. You know, Kyle and Cantor walking out of the talks. I think at the end of the day, the Republicans have to make President Obama, you know, stand up once again and articulate the fact that he's endorsing tax hikes. I mean, if what I'm hearing come out of the meetings is true, that the Democrats wanted both the end of all the Bush tax cuts and a tax hike trigger that could bind future Congresses if the debt reaches a certain level to massive tax increases, are both non-starters and unacceptable. But what I am concerned about is the Republicans painting themselves into a corner just in terms of their rhetoric with something that there might be a consensus for, something along the lines of what Senator Coburn has been hinting at, which is a series of reforms to the tax codes, which could raise revenue by eliminating certain loopholes and subsidies without raising marginal rates. And that is something that might be, though not ideal, necessary to get a balanced budget and to eliminate this deficit, something that my colleague Kevin Williamson has argued vociferously for here. And if it's any indication of where conservatives are at least our readers, we have a poll up on the homepage today, which I encourage everybody to go vote in, which is who's right about taxes, Coburn or Norquist. And it's not just about the ethanol issue. It's about things like tax code reform that might raise revenue. And so far, Coburn is overwhelmingly winning that vote. So I think that's what's going to be necessary at the end of the day. And this talk from the likes of Cantor and Kyle and DeMint that no tax increases of any kind are going to be acceptable might paint them into a corner when eventually they have to start talking about tax code reform.
Dan, do you get the idea that even if Republicans were to embrace the Coburn position based on what you just outlined as the Democratic position, is there really any reason to think the Democrats would consider the Coburn position middle ground that they could agree to?
I do. I think that the Democrats have a history of of buckling on stuff like this, especially in the Senate. If Nancy Pelosi were still in charge of the House, I'd be much more worried about it. But I'll bet you can get the Conrads of the world and the Baucuses of the world behind something like this. There'll be enough moderate Democratic support in the Senate that if Coburn can round up his Republican allies, you might be able to do something on tax code reform. The big question is time. I certainly don't think that they're going to be able to hash anything out by August when supposedly the world is going to explode because we reached the debt ceiling.
Yeah, I don't think much is going to explode on August 2nd, at least because of that. On to the second phase of this, and this is obviously the blame game continuing. Nancy Pelosi being interviewed by the ever-objective Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC. And obviously the topic of the broken down debt ceiling negotiations came up. And here's Nancy Pelosi's reason for optimism that the talks will, in fact, reconvene.
I think these talks will resume because they must. The U.S. government cannot default on its debt, largely accrued by President George W. Bush.
And now, Dan, neither you nor I will ever go to the wall saying that George W. Bush is the model of fiscal responsibility because it's simply not true. And he does bear a substantial portion of the blame for where we are right now with the debt. But the idea that Bush, whose highest annual deficit was about $400 billion, and that's way too much, but it's only a fraction compared to what we saw in the first two fiscal years under Obama and what we're likely to see any time in the foreseeable future, that he is the main reason for why we are where we are seems ludicrous. And the last thing that she should be doing if she's trying to attract any middle ground for this debate or the next campaign.
Nancy Pelosi seems like she might be the last person who still buys the blame Bush argument in terms of this economy. I mean, I think when we were having this conversation 2 years ago, there were plenty of people inclined to buy it. When we were having this conversation a year ago, there were still some people inclined to buy it. Now I think it's just Nancy Pelosi and two guys on Think Progress. And look, if she wants to blame a past president, blame Lyndon Baines Johnson, okay, for our deficit problems. I mean, the major drivers of future deficits are going to be the big entitlement programs and Medicare and Medicaid, you know, chief among them. And so the idea that this is primarily, mainly, primarily,
something like
due to George W. Bush is just ridiculous. You're right, Bush. Bush, you know, spent a ton of money, and compassionate conservatism ended up being really expensive. But a word in defense, you know, this is kind of a Karl Rove talking point, but it happens to be true. Medicare Part D, which was unpaid for, as the Democrats like to point out, and is a big driver of President Bush's contribution to future deficits, still came in under what they thought it was going to cost when they were debating it on the Hill, and it was wildly cheaper than the Democratic alternative at the time. So people who are inclined to hate on Medicare Part D, which I understand, and President Bush for passing it, have to understand that the choice in Congress wasn't between Medicare Part D and nothing, but it was between the Republicans' version, which has come in under cost and is more market-driven, and the Democrats' version, which was wildly more expensive and would have been more state-centric. Now I'll end being a mouthpiece for the Karl Rove crowd now.
Exactly. Plenty of blame to go around, but the present crowd seems to be right there. And as long as Pelosi's assigning blame for what happened in the Bush administration, the largest deficits occurred in his final 2 years. And I'm trying to remember which party was in control of Congress during those years, Dan.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to remember all the way back then.
Yeah, it is. So on to martini number three now. And Newt Gingrich is an interesting fellow, as we've learned over the past, many years, but certainly over the past several weeks since he launched this presidential campaign, which seems to take on more water day by day. He was being interviewed by Bill O'Reilly on the Fox News Channel and obviously asked about the fact that his campaign has gotten off to a rocky start, to put it mildly. And here's his quote. "I think part of it is just that the route I'm taking is a hard route. It's a route that says we're going to talk about very big ideas. We're going to use the internet. We have a site called newt.org. That is why he's in big trouble, because he's talking about big ideas and uses the internet. I'm pretty sure it's because he has now two lines of credit at Tiffany's. No one who was working for him seems to be working for him currently. And he seemed to throw Paul Ryan under the bus, which is the only comprehensive debt plan out there."
To me, I hear talking about big ideas and using the internet, that just tells me that it's a campaign he can run from Greece, right? which I think is his main motivation there. I mean, look, Newt's obviously a brilliant guy, and Newt's a guy who's also prone to delusions of grandeur about his own rhetorical and intellectual powers. So the question is he more smart or is he more deluded? I think that before he announced, you know, when we were kicking around the idea of a Gingrich candidacy, there were arguments to be made for it. And certainly a lot of us thought he would be a welcome voice. But the Gingrich that we got is one who's so sure of his rhetorical powers and his intellectual might that he's not bothering to do any stumping, that he's not bothering to do any fundraising beyond what's sort of necessary to jet set around the country and the world. And he's got no staff that believes that he has any kind of clear path to a nomination. So at this point, I think the Gingrich campaign is a dead letter. The question is, and he'll reveal himself over the next few months in due course, if it is a dead candidacy, is he going to continue the charade of running for the nomination sort of as a way of doing his think tank and entrepreneurial work on campaign finance dime? And if he does that, I think it'll be greatly to the detriment of his credibility.
Yeah, which has already taken a hit, of course. Very interesting to watch him as well as all the others as they try and gain the upper hand here. Dan, great having you with us this week. We'll talk to you later.
Great. Thanks, Greg.
Dan Foster of National Review Online, in for Jim Garrity. Jim will be back on Monday. I will be out next week, though. Brett Winterbull of Radio America will be filling in for me. So join him and Jim Garrity on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.